Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is the MCrit Podcast. Today on the show is part two of the Central Line series. We're going to discuss Central Line placement tips. Before we get started, two announcements. One, this year's ED Critical Care Conference in New York City will be January 13th, 2016 at Mount Sinai. If you are a EM resident or a critical care fellow in New York City, you already have a spot. And hopefully your program directors are already trying to make the time for you guys to come to the conference. Now, if you are not a New York City EM resident or critical care fellow, we probably still have space. And we almost certainly will be able to fit you in. So mark that date on your calendar, but it's just going to take me a couple weeks to get the logistics worked out on how to make sure you have tickets locked down to that event. But you should definitely set it aside, because this year it's going to be a cardiac arrest forum. And the speakers we have already drafted, if we got no one else, this would be maybe the best conference ever for cardiac arrest. So look forward to that. Number two. Our resuscitation advanced training program, which in another universe would be called a resuscitation fellowship, but because of various hospital politics, we have to instead call it advanced training and resuscitation. This first year has been going amazingly. I think the advanced trainees, Reed fellows, have been having an amazing time. And if you are interested for next year, what you want to do is go to resus.cc, that's resus.cc, and what you will find there is a link on the very top of the page to the advanced resuscitation training, and you will wind up contacting our resuscitation advanced training director, Brian Wright, and you can get him your information, and hopefully you'll consider it, because I think it's going to be even better in year two, and year one is already fantastic. I said two announcements, but one more. We are obviously taking residency applications for Stony Brook EM. It just keeps getting better. The program just keeps getting better and better. I've been nothing but amazed by how good the residency is at Stony Brook. And so get your applications in there. Okay, let's get to the show. This show is going to be just a whole bunch of tips and tricks on central line placement. Now, if you go to the show notes, mcrit.org/157, the first thing you're going to see there is a link to a Wii I just put up yesterday on micro skills of central line placement. And you really have to watch that video. It's about 10 minutes long, because it has all of the little tips and tricks on the actual hand placement for syringe removal, wire placement, etc. So I'm not going to dwell on any of that stuff. I'm just going to cover things that are not in that video. So go watch that. Just go to mcrit.org. It's on top of the page. Or if you're listening a year from when this was actually put out, go to mcrit.org/157 and you'll find that link to the video and you should watch it. There's also a bunch of videos on the mcrit.org/, I don't even know what the hyperlink is. But the point is, there's a central line page with videos on how I do an IJ, how I do a subclavian, etc. You should check those out as well, because they're really complementary to what we're going to talk about today. Most of my lines are done with me supervising residents in an ultrasound-guided IJ placement. And so let's just give a few brief words about the IJ placement with ultrasound. First of all, you should be training your residents, or if you yourself are a learner, you should be doing it this way. You should be organizing everything for minimal movement and optimal success. And that means, let's say you're going right IJ. The ultrasound machine should be on your left, the patient's left side of the bed, not on the same side you are. You want to be able to look at your sight and the ultrasound screen without turning your head. And to make that happen, the ultrasound must be facing you. You're at the head of the bed, facing you, just off of the patient's left shoulder. And it's the opposite, obviously, if you're going left IJ. This is going to optimize the ergonomics. There should be a table just off your right hand, assuming you're right hand dominant, meaning just next to the patient's right shoulder, there is a big table, not some stupid tiny little Mayo stand. There is a big table where you have all of the stuff you need in order to place the line, and the items you're going to need right as you're doing your needle stick and wire are the ones closest to your hand, such that you have the ability to grab the wire and put it in without having to reach, without having to turn around, without having to take your field of vision off of where it was when you did your needle stick. So this should be obvious if you just think about it for a second, but you have the ultrasound on the patient's left shoulder and the table on your right. Now, if you are a lefty, depending on what you're using to do your stick, I would say that table still remains in the same place because you probably still are going to use your right hand to grab stuff. But obviously, wherever you feel most comfortable grabbing items is where that table should be positioned. The other thing is, most of these kits now have embedded sharps containers, like a little piece of styrofoam in a plastic cup where you can put your sharps. That should be facing you as you're doing this. And the needle, after you place your wire through it and take the needle out, should be immediately placed in that sharps container. It should never be thrown onto the field on the patient's chest. It should never be thrown into the kit where you're going to be grabbing other stuff. And that's just crazy and is begging for a hepatitis C stick. It always goes directly into the sharps container every single time. All right. The height of the bed should be such that you do not have to stoop, you do not have to feel uncomfortable. But if you're doing a neckline, there should be a relatively significant degree of Trendelenburg, so long as there's not increased intracranial pressure issues precluding that, because you don't want an air embolism. I would say, even in the case of an ICP patient, what I like to do is I keep them sitting up, I get them all prepped, I get them all draped, I get everything ready, I will pop them down for the needle syringe use. I will place the wire. As soon as the wire is in the vessel, I will put them to some small degree of sitting back up. Not enough that I can't, you know, actually finish the line, but I will get them out of Trendelenburg. And so that's really what you want for any neckline placement. For femoral placement, they could either be sitting up. It actually will augment the size of that femoral vessel. But for neckline placement, generally we want some degree of Trendelenburg. If you can't get it, if their ICP is so intractable that even that slight change in position off full sitting up, then you got to work with it. But if you can, Trendelenburg makes the puncture and the risk of air embolism dramatically less. All right, in that micro skills discussion, I have an extensive conversation about how to hold your needle in order to take off the syringe, how to get the wire in without moving that needle, all that stuff. So we're not going to talk about that. Let's talk about, you've gotten the wire through the needle, but you just can't get it to advance much further than that. What's going on? Well, the first thing you should think about is your angle on your needle too acute, and therefore the wire is coming right out of the needle and hitting the back wall of the vessel, and it just can't make the curve to continue down that vessel. That's not uncommon. The move in that case is to take out your wire, put a syringe back on your needle, make sure you're still in the middle of the vessel and that you're getting good blood return, and then see if you can make the angle on your needle less acute. Less, you know, facing the back wall of the vessel and more parallel with the vessel. And so you will gently reposition and then make sure you still have return of blood into your syringe. And if you do, now try passing the wire. And many times that's sufficient. Let's say that didn't work. And let's say enough of the wire had gone in that you're pretty sure you're past the very distal portion of the needle and now it stops. What's going on there? Well, assuming the patient has no vascular abnormalities, what usually is going on is the patient is so volume depleted that their SVC or IVC is actually collapsing as you're trying to place the wire. And this is not uncommon. What you will find is during the respirophasic variations, whether it's a patient who's spontaneously breathing or more commonly in these cases, a patient who's on the vent, there will be a moment at which the vessel gets a little bit bigger and you'll be able to pass the wire. And so what I will do is I will just gently try to advance. And I mean gently. You do not want to dissect the wall of these vessels. Gently try to advance. And at some point in the respiratory cycle, all of a sudden it goes a little bit. And then usually it'll stop again between the breaths. And then, you know, you could just work your way down. And you really are looking for no resistance. If it's going but there's still resistance, that's not good. But sometimes there actually is some resistance, especially if the needle was at an acute angle and it's hitting the back wall of the vessel, but it does keep going. And then sometimes there is resistance. You really just need to get a feel for this. But in general, in these volume depleted patients, there will be a moment during the cycle where you could advance and then it'll stop and then you could advance and then it'll stop. If I'm having any problems with wire advancing, in general, assuming I've had enough of the wire through the needle that I'm sure the wire is intravascular, you know, you just get a sense of how long your needles are and how much wire is in the patient. If there's enough wire that I'm sure I'm in intravascularly, what I will in general do is take the needle off the wire, just leave the wire in the vessel. I know not enough wire is in, but enough is in that I'm in the vessel. I will take the needle out, and then I'll put the catheter, you know, the catheter over the needle in the set that we talked about last episode that I use for pressure transduction. I will put that over the wire. I'll then take the wire out. I will now confirm that that catheter is still intravascular by pulling back with a syringe, or better yet, actually doing the pressure transduction technique with the with either tubing or the wire guide casing. And now I know that that catheter is where I want it to be. And then I will try re-advancing the wire through the catheter, because now I don't have a needle in the vessel that I have to worry about the slightest movement dislodging it. I have all the time in the world to play with that wire, twist. Twisting sometimes helps to get the J wire in a different orientation. I will, if I already have the catheter in, sometimes even use the back of the wire. Now, you have to understand, the preclusion against this was in the old days, only the J-tip side was soft, and the back of your wire was stiff, dangerous, could not be used in a vessel. Every kit I've used in the entire career I've had has had both sides be soft J's. So, soft tips, one side being a J and one side being straight, but both of them soft and made for intravascular use. Confirm your own kit is indeed like this. I don't want to be responsible for destroying vessels, but if it is, you can use the other side, and there have been situations where that'll pass and the J won't. Understand the J is probably safer. Let's say you got your wire in there. Now we move to dilation. Now, I don't have a micro-scale video for dilation, but many commenters have said I should, and they're absolutely right. My micro-scales video was recorded, I think, like 2 years ago, maybe even three. And since then, I certainly would have made a dilation micro-scale, and I still will, because it's maybe the most misunderstood portion of central line placement. And after doing the fellowship training in ECMO stuff, dilation, I didn't understand it, even though I was well into my career until that point of actually learning to place huge catheters. Taught us when we were going through this training that we didn't know how to place small catheters. The thing is, you get away with it on the small catheters very commonly, even though you're doing bad technique. You don't get away with it on the big ones. And so I'm going to give you the proper technique now on how to dilate. You actually have your wire in. The key take-home point for dilation is you never let the wire move forward in the vessel. So you're going to be pushing with your dilator. You have to have a second hand on the wire, preventing it from moving forward along with that dilator. Now, what am I talking about? I grab the wire, and no matter how hard I'm pushing with that dilator, the wire never moves. It never advances any further into the vessel than it already is. Why is this so important? If the wire is allowed to move freely as you push the dilator, if there's any kinking of that wire distal to the dilator, instead of being forced to stay in the middle of the vessel in a parallel orientation to the vessel, could go anywhere it wants. The dilator could backwall the vessel and destroy it, because now the dilator is unconstrained. It's not being forced by the longitudinal guidance of the, you know, held wire. So you must always hold the wire, not just to prevent it, the gremlins from sucking into the vessel, which we said last time was a myth, but instead to prevent the wire from moving forward as you dilate and allowing backwalling and destruction of the vessel. I can't make this any clearer. This is incredibly important. So that's the first tip on dilation. Now, the next tip is always orient the dilator to be parallel as possible to the vessel and always parallel to the wire direction. Now, especially if you needed to use an acute angle in order to get to a very deep femoral vessel, say, now there's going to be a significant angle variation between the vessel and your actual entry into the vessel, between the skin and the vessel itself. That is a dangerous dilation situation where you are very prone to kinking and where you really, really want to take it slow and make sure you're doing it right. And you really don't want to allow any play in that wire for the wire to move forward, or the wire will kink. And then you're kind of hosed. And in a second, we will talk about how to fix that. But let's just talk about the dilation itself. So you have one hand on the wire, and you really should grab the dilator as close to the skin as you can, still having the ability to push forward a little bit. You shouldn't be grabbing it all the way at the hub of the dilator, because then the dilator bends. So you grab it close to the skin. You can use a twisting motion or not. It doesn't really matter. I always make a scalpel nick. There are people who have commented that you don't need it, that you can use the dilator to dilate the skin itself. And I have done that, and you can do it. And it will prevent that annoying bleeding at the site of the scalpel nick. But I would prefer in all cases to make a scalpel nick. And then depending on the patient's anticoagulation status, I will make a generous one or a tiny, tiny little one. But I always just nick the skin just enough for the dilator to go in. Maybe a bit smaller, and then I'll push it open a little bit, but I'm always making a scalpel nick. Do not make an enormous scalpel nick, or in general, the bleeding will be really annoying and piss you off. So you got your scalpel nick. Make sure the nick is contiguous with the entrance of the wire in the skin. What do I mean by this? Sometimes there'll be blood occluding the field, and you'll make your scalpel nick and it'll be a millimeter off. So there'll be one hole the wire goes in, and there'll be a hole you just created with your scalpel, and there's a skin bridge between them. That will destroy the tip of your dilator. And as a result, your dilator tip will blunt. You won't be able to use it anymore safely. You're going to have to open a new kit. If you don't realize the tip is blunt, you will kink the wire for sure, because you'll be using excessive force on that dilator. So I always rotate my wire within the scalpel nick to make sure that it's moving within the scalpel cut I just made, and therefore there is no skin bridging. All right, I'm going to do my dilation. For a triple lumen, a small dilator in general, I'm going to go in one motion. I'm going to hold my wire and move. I've been asked the question recently, how much do you need to dilate? Do you dilate the vessel itself? Do you just dilate the skin and soft tissue below it? And the answer is this. Really, you don't need to dilate anything except the upper portions of the skin and the fascia below it, but the soft tissue below it. But in general, I will place the dilator for a triple lumen to the point of how deep the needle had to go. So I'm probably dilating the vessel. When we place ECMO catheters, we definitely dilate the vessel. The vessels are safe to dilate. When you place a Cordis, you're going to have to dilate the vessel. When you place a dialysis catheter, you're going to have to dilate the vessel. So you absolutely can. Is it necessary? No. But in general, I am not, you know, just dilating one centimeter down. I'm going the full length of how long it took the needle. And if that means I'm hubbing the dilator, that's fine, as long as you are holding the wire properly. And I will just keep re-gripping the dilator until I'm just above the skin, push down a little bit, grip it just above the skin, push down a little bit. I am not pushing from the hub. Now, when you're dilating with the bigger lines, you really change your technique a little bit, because the dilators are much, much larger, especially the dialysis catheters that are like 13 French. For those, what I will do is I will push my dilator close to the skin, that one first push, so maybe like a third of the dilator goes in, or even a quarter, and then I will rack my wire back and forth to make sure the wire is still free and unkinked, by which I mean I grab the wire just behind the hub of the dilator, and I move it out a centimeter, I move it in a centimeter. If it flows freely, I know that dilator is still tracking on an unkinked wire. And now I will push in another quarter of the dilator, whether you rotate or not. And then I will rack the wire back and forth. And then I will push in more of the dilator, rack the wire. Push in more of the dilator, rack the wire. And depending on how deep I had to go with that needle is how much of that dilator I'll push in. I do the same thing with a cordis. The cordis dilator obviously is always inside the cordis sheath itself. It's not a separate dilation step, but I will push in, you know, a quarter of that dilator and cordis. I will rack my wire. I will push in more, rack my wire, push in more, rack my wire. I do this for any large vessel dilation. And if you're having any problems dilating with a triple lumen, smaller dilator, do the same thing. Make sure your wire is still free. What if your wire is not free? What if it doesn't move? That means you have a kink. Kinks are annoying. Now, if you've done the wrong depth of wire insertion, by which I mean, really, on a 60 centimeter triple lumen wire, only half of it should be in, 30 centimeters. If it's marked, you'll know how far you're in because there'll be like one bar, two bar, three bar. That's as deep as you go. My rule of thumb for a neckline is there should always be enough wire sticking out that the wire's not past the top of the patient's head when I'm placing a triple lumen catheter. If I've gone past the patient's head, I have way too much wire in. If you have gone in with way too much wire, meaning, you know, you only have like 5 centimeters of the wire sticking out and you're probably like have it curled around in the right atrium, what you can do is pull the wire out until you see the kink. And then, since the kink is now outside the patient, you can externally work your dilator over the kink and dilate on fresh wire. And then you take your dilator out and you put your catheter over the kink and then you get it all the way through and then you'll place your catheter and you could advance that in general over the kink because the kink is now contained inside the catheter as you're advancing. But that really is a stopgap maneuver. The better maneuver, if you have a kink on your wire, is to take the catheter over the needle from your kit, take out the needle, put the catheter over the kink wire. It'll go easy as pie. Pull out the kink wire, put your finger over the catheter, and get a new wire. You don't obviously leave. You have someone bring you a new kit. They open it so that you could touch the sterile portion. You grab a new wire, and you place that wire in the catheter and take the catheter out. That's the smart way to go. You can handle it if you had a lot of wire in to get the kink externalized, but you will never work with an internalized kink. You will screw up your dilator. You're going to screw up the vessel. Don't do that. All right, a few things about site-specific stuff. We already talked about some IJ stuff. If you're going to do an IJ, you use ultrasound, obviously. If you're not going to use an ultrasound for an IJ, then do a subclavian. So IJ, in general, you're looking at the vessel, so you generally know where you are. Some subclavian stuff. In the show notes for this episode, I have a discussion of the ambush maneuvers. Those are ways of preventing the wire and therefore the catheter from going into the subclavian and up the IJ. You actually occlude the fossa and collapse the IJ, forcing the wire in the right place. In general, I don't do that until it's messed up. So I see an X-ray, the IJ is going up. What I will do in that case, you know, it's gone in the subclavian, then it's popped up, or it's gone in the wrong place, like to the contralateral subclavian. You generally don't want to do a fresh stick. You've already put the patient through that risk of pneumothorax and stuff. So I will change those out. How do you change these out? And this is just as applicable for an IJ that's gone in the wrong place. Sometimes the IJ will go into the subclavian. What I do in these cases is I get a new kit. I sterilize everything. I place, you know, full sterile now, a wire into the malposition catheter, sufficient such that I know the tip of the wire is outside the catheter. I take the old catheter out. I then place the catheter over the needle, just the catheter portion of the catheter over the needle, onto the wire. Now I have a short catheter over the wire that just will be in the IJ or the subclavian. I take the wire out. Now I'm going to reposition the wire using all of the magic that I probably should have used on the first time, meaning I'm going to use the ambush maneuver, meaning I'll have an assistant or my other, you know, piece of my hand holding the hub of the catheter. I'm going to use the other fingers to occlude that fossa. I'm going to aim the J so that the J portion itself faces the patient's feet. I'm going to make sure the arm is pulled down against the patient's body. I'm going to do everything possible to make sure that wire goes in the right place. If you have one of those X-ray machines in your hospital that have the screen on it, I will even take an X-ray of the wire before I do my threading so that I could get this real time. Or if you're really savvy with ultrasound and you could get someone to pop the ultrasound on and see the wire in the right atrium, that's also very workable. And then I will complete the line by removing that catheter and then doing the normal stuff. Actually, I should have gone back to the IJ. One thing people don't understand, if you use ultrasound enough, you probably grasp this, but it's worth talking about. Extreme contralateral head turning actually makes the IJ more likely to overlie the carotid, not less likely. So don't do that. Neutral position or maybe slightly turned away from your site is all you want. Subclavian stuff. Back to it again. The arm should be against the body and pulled downwards. This is the most effective way of orienting the subclavian with the clavicle such that the landmarks always work. Look at my subclavian video to understand how I'm doing this, but the reference for that is in the show notes. Do not pad behind the patient. That actually turns out not to work, and I could have told you that from the many failed subclavians I had in my first fellowship until I realized that was crap. So don't do that. Femoral. If there's overlying pannus obscuring your site, you need to take some 2 or 3 inch tape, usually 4 or 5 pieces of this, put them on the pannus, and then tape that pannus up to a rail of a bed. This is a horrible indignity to a patient, and I despise it, and I hate doing it. And if the patient was conscious and not intubated, I actually asked their permission before doing this. But this indignity is much better than the sticking them multiple times, hitting their femoral artery, and not being able to get your ultrasound in there and losing sterility because the pannus is overlying your site. Really think twice whether it's really a good idea to do a femoral placement, because when you untape that pannus, it's going to flop down onto your site and probably lead to nice moist environments for bacteria. Sometimes you have no choice. So if this is the only site you could use for whatever reason, tape up the pannus or have an assistant withdraw the pannus, do your line, really cover it well. I'll use multiple tegaderms in that case to really obscure the site from that pannus falling back on it. All right, the last thing I want to talk about, this is much longer than a normal episode, is can you do central lines on anticoagulated patients? The answer is yes, you can. The first thing to say is if the anticoagulation is solely due to liver disease and they have like an INR of 4, they are probably not even anticoagulated. They just have a shortage of factor 7. They probably are clotting fine, and you shouldn't worry too much about doing a paracentesis, a central line on those patients. But let's say they actually are anticoagulated. They're on Coumadin or Xarelto or I should say rivaroxaban, so I'm not using the brand name, what have you. Can you do a line? Yes. You just have to be more cognizant and safe. What is the best site? If they're intubated, the best site is the IJ, because there's nothing the hematoma is going to do to an intubated patient in those cases, and that is my site of source. I could apply direct pressure. Can you do a subclavian? Yes, we did it all the time at the trauma center because their collars were on. We had no choice, and a lot of them were on dialysis. But it's my least favorite choice. IJ is my favorite. If they're not intubated, IJ or femoral. Femoral is probably a little bit nicer, but if you're going to do femoral, you want to make sure you stay away from a retroperitoneal puncture, back walling into the retroperitoneum. So you want to go lower than you normally would. So right at where it branches from 2 to 1 is you know, just above that is where you want to go, and that'll keep you out of the retroperitoneum and lead things to still be compressible. My advanced resuscitation trainee, Reed Fellow, Rory Spiegel, who writes the EM Nerd, introduced me to a set called a micropuncture set. This is what the IR guys use as their initial puncture, and then they'll squirt dye in it and then actually make their big dilation from that point. These micropuncture sets, very small needle, a 4 French catheter that doesn't require a dilator at all. If I have to do central lines on anticoagulated patients, what I do now is I do the initial stick with a micropuncture set. This needle's so small, even if you hit a carotid on these anticoagulated patients, tiny, tiny stick. It's nothing. Even on the anticoagulated patient, they will not bleed out from a carotid stick at all. Like, you'll just hold pressure for 2 minutes, they'll be fine. It probably should be longer than that. But the point is, this is a tiny needle. A beautiful wire, though the key is on this wire, you cannot use the back end. The back end is super stiff and dangerous, only the J-tip on this. And then, since I don't need to dilate, I could just put in this 4 French catheter. It's this beautiful set. I will then take out the internal dilator on this. And I should say, you are dilating, but you're not doing a secondary dilation step. The dilator is built in. It's small. You don't need to make a scalpel nick at all. And then all of a sudden, I have a 4 French catheter in there, and I could stop. I could do my vessel confirmation. I could feel really good that I'm dilating a vein And then I will go and do my central line like normal. I'll put my long wire in. I'll take out this micropuncture catheter, and I'll go from there. So this is how I do it on anticoagulated patients right now. It'll reach a femoral site. It'll reach an IJ site. It'll reach a subclavian site. It is really, really nice. Actually, you know what? Don't quote me on that subclavian thing. I don't think I've ever done a subclavian with this micropuncture set, so don't do that yet. I'm sure it'll be fine, but I want to check on that if the needle's long enough for a subclavian. But certainly for an IJ or for a femoral, it is golden. All right, that was a whole bunch of stuff. I'm sure you have questions. I'm sure I missed things. So by all means, put those in the comments, mcrit.org/157, and then I will fix them on the probably last of the Central Line series, which will probably be just a random assortment of crap. Scott Weingart, MCrit Podcast, saying bye-bye.